The country, this reading is from Cornell West. The country is in deep trouble. We've forgotten that a rich life consists fundamentally of serving others, trying to leave the world a little better than when you found it. We need the courage to question the powers that be, the courage to be impatient with evil and patient with people, the courage to fight for social justice. In many instances, we will be stepping out on nothing and just hoping to land on something. But that's the struggle. To live is to wrestle with despair, yet never allow despair to have the last word. A few weeks ago, Nicholas Kristof, the progressive New York Times columnist who grew up near here in Yamhill, wrote a column titled, Why 2017 Was the Best Year in Human History. He acknowledged that this is a surprising perspective for American progressives who have spent the last year thinking it was the worst year that we can remember in a very long time. Our president is unstable at best and unable to discern the difference between truth and lies. New laws and policies are ripping the safety net to shreds and hurting people and families and the environment. Our foreign policy is isolating and dangerous. From a world perspective, however, Kristof writes, human life has been steadily better. As recent as the 1960s, a majority of humans have always been illiterate and lived in extreme poverty. Now, fewer than 15% are illiterate, and fewer than 10% live in extreme poverty. In another 15 years, illiteracy and extreme poverty will be mostly gone. After thousands of generations, they are pretty much disappearing on our watch. The website Future Crunch lists 99 reasons 2017 was a great year. So sermon writers are told not to share in a sermon more than one or two statistics. The reason for that is that it just gets boring and monotonous and lecture-like, and who can remember all of those statistics anyway? But there was 99 really great statistics about why 2017 was a great year. So I couldn't choose just one or two. So bear with me. It turns out that even with the terrible natural disasters last year, the world had the lowest deaths from natural disasters ever. Countries are learning in the face of great climate trauma, how to save lives more effectively. 9 out of 10 children went to school last year in the world. In 1970s, only half the children in the world went to school. Deaths and rates of tropical diseases continued to fall dramatically. For example, in 1986, 3.5 million people were infected by the excruciatingly painful guinea worm. Last year, there was only 25 cases. Last year, China invested $100 billion into treating and preventing water pollution, as well as investing in solar energy and shutting down thousands of coal plants. A shareholder rebellion forced ExxonMobil, the world's largest oil company, to start reporting on the effect of climate change in their annual reports. TransCanada terminated the tar sands pipeline. The UK stopped burning coal, period. Canada became the ninth country to allow third genders on passports and government documents. And surprisingly, the number eight was Pakistan. More countries are acknowledging LGBTQ rights. The number of people in prison in the United States dropped. Since 1990, rates of violent and property crime have fallen by 50% in the United States. Snow leopards have been on the endangered species list since 1972, but the species has gotten so robust that they came off this year. Genetic dolphins returned from near extinction. And in the United States, women are reporting sexual harassment and assault. And for the first time, so many men are being held accountable. When I first read all this good news, I felt a little disoriented. This is not the world that I see every day. I read the daily update from the New York Times and listen to OPB, and I get the panicked emails from progressive groups. And while I often just read the line, it always feels like the world is in a complete crisis. And this late winter, I have felt really sad and depressed as the far-right conservative agenda is slowly getting implemented. A tax law that increases taxes on the poor and middle class over time, increases the deficit, and gives more money to the wealthy has just felt suffocating to me. And then our country plans to send out to deport 200,000 El Salvadorians and move them away from their families and communities to a place that by all accounts is extremely dangerous. It just feels unbelievable to me. And that it took Congress months to renew a health care funding for disadvantaged and vulnerable children when they could pass a tax law in like 2 weeks. And that we can't come up with a solid plan for Dreamers just feels shocking to me. I have made my phone calls. I have signed petitions. I have done all the things I knew to do to stop these things. But it has felt like it doesn't matter. My side feels like it's losing. People are being deported away from families and friends and held without due process in prisonous detention centers. People die crossing the border from thirst and harsh conditions. And just this week, a young man was arrested for putting water out in the desert to save lives. This is wrong. It is simply morally wrong. And it doesn't take so much for me to start feeling that when it comes to justice, what I do doesn't matter very much. This perspective, though, I have learned, is a very white supremacist culture way to think and feel about justice work. White culture holds perfectionism as ideal. Everything must be done the right way. We must know what to do, and we must do it perfectly. White culture teaches us that individualism is natural and normal. We are each alone and responsible for ourselves and the state of the world. Individuals do things. The corollary is that things are best done on our own. We shape the stories we tell about justice and social change to highlight these perspectives of white culture. We tell stories of justice heroes. These individuals make things happen. They are successful. In our stories, we tidy these people up and make them perfectly talented and capable. We make them a little superhuman. We don't mention their collaborators and communities. We tell nothing of the people who came before them, who worked hard with little success. We just forget those people. In the moment they failed, And we don't tell stories of justice failures. White supremacist culture likes to focus on what is successful. Olive Schneider was a white South African feminist and anti-apartheid activist who lived around the beginning of the 1900s. And she was those things so long before there were any feminists and so long before there were anti-apartheid activists. And you have probably never heard of her. She did not lead any great movements worthy of our history books and storytelling, but her writing deeply influenced the Reverend Howard Thurman, who you might have heard of, but you might not have. Thurman is considered one of the great preachers of the 20th century and one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s teachers and mentors. In one of her essays, Schneider tells the story of a dream. In it, a woman seeks the land of freedom, but it is across a big and wild river. She is afraid and does not know the way. She cannot see a path or any other people to lead her. A old man says to her, "Have you seen the locusts cross the stream? First one comes down to the water's edge, and it is swept away. And then another comes, and then another, and then another, and at last with their bodies piled up becomes a bridge, and the rest can pass over it." But what of those who come first, she asked him, those that are swept away and are heard no more, and their bodies do not even build a bridge? "They are swept away and are heard of no more," he agrees. "And what of that?" she asks. "They make a track to the water's edge." They make a track to the water's edge. Unitarian minister Reverend Theodore Parker said, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. From what I see, I am sure that it bends toward justice." The moral arc is a long one. And on the way, many hold on to that arc and help bend it towards justice. Many of those people are just making a track to the water's edge. Their names are not recorded in history books or in our memories. They never became heroes with a national holiday. But they mattered a lot. The stories we tell are stories of perfection and success. We don't remember the people who failed, who did not get great acts of legislation passed, who did not change the hearts and minds of people. We don't see or hear about all those people who made the track to the water's edge. We also tend not to see all the other people in the stories. Those who build the rafts and the paddles and make the maps and pack the food. Because in our stories, the heroes are individuals and superhuman. We don't see the hero's community and allies. We don't see their collaborators. Our attention gets narrowed on one person, a public face, who acted in a way that was successful, that made change happen. The stories we tell about power and change disempower us. We cannot imagine being Rosa Parks, or most of us can't, I can't, tired and refusing to give up her seat to a white man and thus being arrested and fined. We hold her up as a hero and don't see all the people who did the very nitty-gritty hard organizing work that made the Montgomery bus boycott possible. We don't see all those who made the track to the river that made that moment powerful and meaningful. We don't see all those who made the track to the river. We don't tell the story, the true story, that Rosa was a trained activist. a member of the NAACP, that she was crossing, and all the people who worked with her, that whole community, was crossing the river on the bodies of all those who worked for racial justice for years before that happened. The stories we tell about change and social justice don't help us. They don't empower us. Change does not really ever happen through perfectly organized moments planned by heroes with perfect strategies that will demonstrate their perfectness through actual successes. I mean, we all know this. Of course, we really, really know this. But the stories we tell about justice heroes are seductive. They are clear and linear. When our actions seem to us like ineffectual drops of water, it's easy to think we don't matter, that we cannot impact change. Social change is never clear. It is never linear. There aren't usually clear, worn paths down to the river. There are a lot of drops of water sitting alone in buckets. The future and change are completely unpredictable. Movements for social change zig and zag this way and that. Efforts move forward and backward. Change can be so very slow. It can feel chaotic and crazy and frustrating or impossible, and then suddenly quick. The civil rights movement of the 1950s and the 1960s was not a movement that flowed forward smoothly to its outcome of civil rights legislation. It was chaotic and difficult, and people didn't know what to do. They got afraid, and leaders argued, and organizations with the same goals disagreed on methods, just as they do today. King wasn't a hero during the civil rights movement. He was a highly unpopular radical. In the book, The Radical King, Cornel West points out that at the time of King's death, most of the country didn't even like him. There was intense FBI pressure, including attempts to make him commit suicide, West writes. The black civil rights leadership was trashing him. The white establishment had rejected him. The young black revolutionaries were dismissing him. We created the story of King as hero later because it served the interests of the idea that justice is created by heroes. At the time, things were really chaotic and messy, and often things didn't work as planned. The future cannot be known. Things come together in unexpected ways. In the lived present moment, it is difficult, very difficult, to know what to do, and the impact of our actions is always going to be unknowable. Stories of history show us this. The Me Too movement ripped through social media in days, giving women voice and power and taking down men who had felt for years perfectly safe professionally while sexually harassing and assaulting women. That women's voice should have power seemed impossible until it happened. The Me Too movement did not come from nowhere, however. Women, some remembered and some forgotten, made a path to the river. Over the years, women did report abuse, and sometimes they were listened to, and men faced consequences, but not most of the time. Remember Anita Hill. And there are all the women we don't know the names of. It was Tarana Burke, a black woman, who created the Me Too hashtag 10 years ago. It didn't take off then. That action simply sat there, an experiment that seemed to have failed. A year ago, the Stanford rape victim released a letter to her perpetrator that created waves of public outrage. When the actress Alyssa Milano suggested that women use the Me Too hashtag, there was an alchemy in that moment that led to change. However, Milano's Twitter suggestion could have simply just fallen flat. It could have just been another experiment, another trial action. The result of her action, her Twitter, was completely unknowable at the time she typed those words. Did you know that Gandhi visited London just as British women occupied the British Parliament demanding the right to vote? One of the women told Gandhi, "I shall never obey any law in the making of which I had no part. I will not accept the authority of the court executing those laws." Gandhi wrote of them, "Today the whole country is laughing at them, and they have only a few people on their side. But undaunted, these women work on steadfastly on their cause. They are bound to succeed and gain the franchise." He realized the power of that protest and found hope for the actions of Indian citizens in British Africa, fighting for their rights. Rebecca Sonnet, who wrote the book Hope in the Dark, points out that the British suffragists influenced Gandhi, who influenced MLK. But first, Howard Thurman, who influenced MLK. That is something the British suffragettes could never have imagined. At that time, they were a small group protesting, not knowing if they could even get the right to vote. They certainly never imagined their protest would offer hope to leaders of civil rights movements across the world. In the early 1960s, a small group of women organized Women's Strike for Peace, the first anti-nuclear movement in the U.S. One of their actions was to stand day in and day out outside of the White House with signs of protest. One of the women from that movement later said how foolish and futile she felt standing in the rain protesting. Nothing was changing. Nothing was happening. But years later, she heard Dr. Benjamin Spock, who became one of the most influential voices on anti-nuclear issues, say that he got involved with the issue because he saw a small group of women standing in the rain with signs outside the White House. He thought, they are so committed. Maybe I should find out a little more about nuclear issues. Those women were making a path to the river. They were drops of water jumping into the bucket. Consider all the good things that happened in 2017. More literacy, less poverty, less deaths from tropical diseases, meaningful action against fossil fuel, once endangered species flourishing. I don't know the names of any of the people who diligently worked to make those changes a reality in our world. Surely they sometimes felt confused, ineffective, foolish, despairing as they took tiny, small actions towards change. And this is the nature of the work for social change. However, at times, at least in our country, we seem to be moving steadily towards policies that create more suffering for the most marginalized. Those movements, while all of that is happening here, those movements over time, over decades, have created a better world without heroes, without fanfare, without national holidays. So, our motivation to work for justice isn't measurable successes, like passed laws, changed hearts, shifted policies. What might be the motivation to work for justice. The first one is hope. When we act, protest, resist, and create in the service of our deeply held values, possibilities open up for the future. We can't know. We don't get to know how our actions will matter specifically. But we can have a deep faith that standing for our deepest value creates tracks to the river and helps build the boats and the maps and feed people as we work for justice. When we act, even when we act imperfectly, which is actually the only way we get to act, even if we don't have a clue about the right thing that will make a difference and our actions seem silly and futile, like standing in the rain with a protest sign for days on end outside the Kennedy White House, even if it feels like that, we are unleashing potential possibilities into existence that can build and grow and connect with other possibilities to create unexpected, unimaginable change. The other motivation to work for justice is to build relationships. And relationships is what truly sustains us, gives us meaning, and makes our lives better. And when we work with others for justice, we build lasting relationships. Working together for our values creates bonds and a connection in a way that socializing does not. We bring our hearts and souls to that work, and so do others, and we connect. In social justice work, we have the opportunity to build relationships with people who are different than we are, who have different cultural norms, different ideas, and different experiences so far outside our own. Relationships open our heart and build our souls and expand our spirits. So this is what I ask of you. What breaks your heart? In our unjust and sometimes cruel world, what breaks your heart? And this is what I ask. Find others whose hearts are also breaking about the same thing and build relationships with them and networks. Imagine and dream and act even when it seems utterly unclear what the right thing to do is. Acting is what matters. And I will tell you that the work for justice, that when you work for justice, when you try to build the perfect community, it is best for all of us to embrace imperfection. Imperfection is beautiful and awkward and crazy and truth. We also need to embrace chaos and the complete unknowability of the future. There's so much hope in the unknowability of the future. And knowing that sometimes things just change in unimaginable ways for the good. What we must do is love and hope. We must commit and act. We must stand on the side of love and stand for justice. We must knock on our neighbors' doors and tell them about the benefits of Measure 101 or whatever else comes along. When we commit and act, when we love and hope, we come alive. And that is what we all want. Mm-hmm. I would like us to stand together and sing 1028, Fire of Commitment.